from the campus of Stanford University.
Now, DNA contains the blueprints for how your cells live, how they grow, how they interact with other cells.
This is the future of everything.
Like a computer program, it allows the cell to perform simple computations to make decisions about when and where things happen.
With your host, Russ Altman.
Today on The Future of Everything, the future of misinformation. So, misinformation is false information, often created deliberately and intended to deceive. Misinformation, also sometimes known by some as fake news, has taken the internet by storm, especially in the last decade. It turns out that social media like Facebook, Twitter, and others are not just good at keeping touch with your friends and your grandmother, but they also provide a platform for creating and spreading false information. There are other ways to do it as well through traditional media. Now, while there always have been lies and falsehoods, the internet has become a powerful amplifier for these. And so now your crazy uncle's theories can garner thousands or millions of followers. Now, why would anybody do this, you might ask? Well, it's the normal reasons: selling things to you, selling ideas to you to influence your opinions, political or otherwise, disrupting your relationships and your trust networks, advancing political agendas. So this is not a theoretical problem. There are theories about health that are spread that could be dangerous to the health of the public. There are rumors about conspiracies that are at minimum distracting and at maximum damaging. And of course, we've all heard about hackers and elections, and I suspect we might be talking about that. So misinformation spreads on the internet faster than true information. There's been studies that show this, and it's kind of intuitive. Fake information is interesting. It's surprising. It allows you to forward to your friends and neighbors. But unfortunately, we humans appear to be quite gullible, sometimes willing to believe crazy stuff, setting aside common sense and the normal filters that would allow us to function in a way that's grounded in reality. Well, Rene D'Aresta is a research manager at the Stanford Internet Observatory, a laboratory devoted to studying how the internet can be abused and how we can detect, expose, and counter misinformation. Rene, there was an election in 2020. How did it go from the perspective of manipulation and the use of misinformation?
Yeah, well, there's still an election going on. we're kind of in that gray period, I think a lot of us actually expected to be in, so I can talk a little bit about that. So we use misinformation to mean information that's inadvertently wrong, and then disinformation to mean information that's deliberately wrong. It's kind of a like a niche distinction there. But the reason being, intent really does matter. You know, there are people who share information that's wrong because of kind of an altruistic desire to help their community, right? They sincerely believe what they're sharing, as opposed to disinformation, where there is this element of, you know, as you mentioned, a grift perhaps, right? Somebody who is pushing false content just to make some money off it, or state-sponsored interference, where they know what they're saying is untrue, or they themselves are inauthentic actors, but they're doing it anyway.
So disinformation is the thing that I was really describing and worried about.
Yep. But interestingly, I mean, in the context of, you know, COVID-19, which we can talk about, misinformation became a really significant facet too. And even now in election 2020, a lot of the people who are sharing the stories about voter fraud and such things sincerely, wholeheartedly believe them. So where we are today, I would say, we're about a week and a half past the election now. And we all expect, researchers who study these things expected to see certain phenomena happen. We expected to see real events. So there are always irregularities in an election. There's always some place where voter fraud actually does happen at a very small scale. You know, somebody submits a ballot that isn't theirs. We expected to see, voting machines occasionally do, in fact, go down. But what happens is when you take these isolated incidents mm-hmm. and you weave them together into a vast narrative alleging conspiracy, that's when you've kind of crossed into the realm of you're no longer sharing a story that happened. You're kind of using motivated reasoning to insinuate at that point that all of these things are connected and there's some powerful cabal of people who are trying to steal the election from the rightfully elected president.
Right.
And that is That is actually a dangerous piece of misinformation, because the or disinformation, depending on where it originates, because what happens at that point is you have very, very large communities of people who sincerely believe that the election is illegitimate if their candidate doesn't win, and who will not just simply, you know, give up that thought on Inauguration Day. And so there is the potential for very real sustained fissures in society around something at this point as fundamental as, you know, the peaceful transfer of power in a democratic election, which is something that our country has done for several hundred years now.
Do we know the degree to which that sense of this is a rigged, terrible election, is that really a new phenomenon? I just don't know the history of whether in the 1870s people were saying similar things because of the horses and the carriages, you know, and whatever. You know, I don't know. You can see how deep my knowledge of it is 19th century history.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. There's always been misinformation, right? And trying to understand and contextualize it, I think, is part of the challenge for us as researchers, but also for the public and for journalists and media as well. So, you know, there used to be election week, you know, because per your point, the horses and carriages, it wasn't like everybody found out from watching, you know, that very talented man with the maps, you know, on television, right? And so, so there is definitely our, you know, the internet has really kind of, or mass media actually has really changed our expectation around the speed with which information comes to us and the assumption that there is reliability when it is communicated to us. And as we've now seen with the election and also even with COVID, there's an that expectation of internet speed and complete accuracy are often at odds with each other. So I think that, you know, there have been contested elections. We have always, I think, Bush versus Gore, even, for example. But at that point, there was a belief that we could rely on the courts. And there wasn't, I don't think, barring small communities of people, this mass, millions of people aggregating on social platforms to challenge the fundamental legitimacy and to allege that the other party had, you know, committed this mass coordinated fraud, which is where things immediately went on election night. So there's, I think, a not necessarily a difference in kind of narrative, but difference in degree. And then also the difference in the speed with which it spreads in the community and how it moves. So how information moves is different. The virality and velocity component really transform, again, the speed with which we're receiving information, the kind of decrease in accuracy a lot of the time, the phenomenon of some people are saying becoming a that sort of person to person disinformation from a misinformation from a friend dynamic that's happening. I think that one of the things that we've seen is even just on Facebook, it's an infrastructure for organizing. So all of the people from all over the country who hold this belief can come together in one place.
Yeah, you can find 70 million or so people who might disagree with you. On either side.
And that it provides an opportunity to really reinforce, reinforce those claims, reinforce those beliefs.
This is The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman. I'm speaking with Rene D'Aresta about disinformation and misinformation. I referred to the social media platforms in my introduction, but I want to recognize that there might be other platforms that are on the hook. So are we also seeing this in other mass media that are not kind of internet-based, or is that in some way tamped down and less prone to these kinds of...
That's a really interesting question. So there's, I think our idea of mass media versus social media as being two distinct things, I don't think that's the way that we should be thinking about it at this point. And one of the things that social media has facilitated is, so first of all, it's a channel, right? So mass media all have all use social media as a channel. New York Times has a Facebook page, you name it, any CNN, all of them have Facebook pages with millions of followers. I think CNN has about 35 million, likes on its page. And so they do have large audiences that they maintain on social media. Even people who don't necessarily watch the television program, you know, particularly generationally, not everybody has a TV anymore. And so they're getting their news from the internet. There's also, though, social media really facilitated the rise of this kind of demi-media, right? Like a sort of like a tier of, there's sort of one, they have the legitimacy, they have the trappings of media. They have their Facebook page is really indistinguishable from CNN's Facebook page. They don't necessarily have the same commitment to journalistic integrity. They're not necessarily journalists. Oftentimes they're pundits, but there's this sort of emergent pundit class that kind of came about that actually kind of serves as an interesting bridge between media and social media. And so the phenomenon that we see is sometimes the narratives originate at the top and come down. So media does an investigation and then releases writes an article, which is then digested by this kind of pundit class and, you know, discussed also by the people on social media.
Amplified.
That's one way information can flow. And that's much more the traditional mechanism. You know, when we talk about something like propaganda, it coming from the top down, it coming from media and institutions and making its way to the people. But what we have today is the phenomenon of the bottom up, where people in a Facebook group can come up with a theory or a claim or a, you know, activism initiative that they want to promote. They have all of the tools of creation and dissemination available to them. They have the platform affordances of virality and velocity. And so determined groups of people can make something hit the top by starting at the bottom. So you have, for example, on election day, conspiracy theories about Sharpie markers, which did not originate because mass media was saying them. And actually, in fact, you know, they really kind of took off in Arizona, which Fox News was, I think, one of the first to call for Joe Biden. But in these determined communities, looking to understand how that possibly could have happened, they sort of seized on this narrative that they had been given Sharpie markers, and so their ballots were not properly processed and read. And that idea about the Sharpie markers was taken and was amplified by this kind of demi-media class, which immediately began to live stream about it, you know, showed up to, they went and they marched outside of the Maricopa County election,
right.
The ballot counting facilities.
Right.
Live streaming the whole time. Again, you know, these are the sorts of things. You used to need a camera crew, now you've got your phone. And right. So that dynamic, then eventually, the press covers the content that it's seeing in the live stream. And then interestingly, what we saw in that particular case is local news in Arizona trying to debunk the claims of the protesters while covering the story so as to add that context and try to, you know, make it clearer what was happening. And then again, the cycle kind of continues. So now we have a news organization that's written an article, posted it to their Facebook page, and then the people who are in these groups go and comment on that article.
Right, so they've already won the game in some way.
So this idea that information is a top-down production, I think, is something that we need to move away from. I feel like that's one of the change of the internet, as far as, you know, my belief here is that propaganda was democratized. It can come from the bottom up as well at this point. And understanding the dynamics there and how that bottom up and top down intersect is where we need to be to understand how.
I have two questions that are related. One is, are the people who do this, do they have talents? Should I think about the people who are effective at this as like, they've been always there with us. They were there during the 1870s, but now they have all the things they need for their genius to blossom. Or is that way, way too strong? And actually almost anybody can do this because the tools are also there and so powerful. I'm trying to figure out if there's some genius involved here that like perhaps I don't have, but that other people do have.
I think, you know, it's funny. I've got a almost 7-year-old and you know, he has never known a world without YouTube and an iPad, right? And so he has always had a camera at his disposal.
Right.
And funny enough, that's what he can get to from the lock screen, right? You know, when we're like, you can't use your iPad right now. He still has a
camera. Okay, I'll just take pictures of mom and dad.
Or video, actually, of his sister, you know, him and his sister doing things. And it's really, it's fascinating to me because he sees it as like, it's just, it's obvious that he would then go and put that video on YouTube. Like, that's just what you do.
Wow.
And so there is, I think, whereas for me, I would actually find that mortifying, like the idea of live streaming. And it's just not a thing that I feel is part of who I am. But there is, you know, there are these shifts where people who are talented have the, you know, this is actually the great kind of a boon of the internet, right? That we're finding all of these people, that there are fascinating content creators. There are channels on YouTube who are just, you know, a person who has an opinion or a point of view sitting in their room telling you about their life or their what they care about, making artistic content, live streaming a video game. So there is that I think it is possible to hit a degree of attention capture, right? To develop a degree of influence or a fandom. In a way where previously you would have had to, you know, if you think about it, you'd have to kind of clear the gatekeepers, right? So
get the credentials, get people to focus on you, the barriers to entry. So there is a little bit of a special, without overstating it, there is a little bit of a talent or a unstated charisma that might make some people more able to do this as part of their just gifts that they've received. So the other part that I wanted to hit though is your 7-year-old going to be really good at wading through the good stuff and the bad stuff? Like, because this is part of their life. And I'm an optimist. Those two reasons, because it's part of life and because Russ is an optimist, are we going to have the next generation very skeptical about everything they hear and much more able to sift through and find truth? Or is that just Pollyanna, not going to happen, Russ?
I think that's where a lot of people are asking that question now. Definitely media literacy has become an emergent focus, particularly in the age of social media. I remember in college being told like Wikipedia is not a source, right? So, you know, I started in 99 to date myself here, but Wikipedia is not a source. You have to click on the link in Wikipedia, go to the primary source, read the primary source, cite the primary source, and that's how you—
I have given that.
You know. And so even then there was that shift, but at the same time, this kind of explosion of different types of media had not yet happened. And so understanding what is a reputable source or what the partisan slant of a particular media property is, understanding if a blogger is doing investigative work or just spouting off, you know, again, you can cite the source that, right, or getting paid. That doesn't mean that there's a, you know, that it's quality information. Right. So helping people understand that. One of the things that's been interesting that we saw was the prevalence of election misinformation on TikTok, which does skew much younger.
Right.
And so, again, you know, Facebook, not surprising, big boomer population on Facebook at this point, you know, it's just kind of well documented. I mean, I'm there.
Sorry. Yeah.
But young people using TikTok. So we actually had a team when we were doing our election monitoring that was looking specifically at content on Snapchat or Snap, I guess it goes by, Instagram stories, Facebook stories, you know, really getting into the stories,
yes,
kind of the fleeting content, the content that really is very much geared to younger audiences. And what we found was that misinformation that would appear on one platform would make it to TikTok. And so if somebody did a YouTube stream where they were, you know, saying whatever, some wild piece of misinformation or some conspiracy theory, that would be kind of snipped and turned into what's called a duet on TikTok, where the person who is, you know, who it is their TikTok, they're creating the content, has this sort of video kind of alongside them and they're shown reacting to it, right? And so that that idea of content related to the election taking the form of reactions to misinformation, it's like Inception, you know, there's like a couple of different—
And that actually, I could see that as being a powerful tamping mechanism to say, you know, just to expose something as ridiculous and kind of be one of the cool people who says this is BS, or they could be saying this is great, we should all believe this. This is the future of everything. I'm Russ Altman, and we'll be right back with our guest, Renee DiResta, about disinformation, misinformation, elections, health, and other things next on Sirius XM.
The future of everything with Russ Altman.
I'm an enthusiast, I'm not a journalist.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman. I'm speaking with Renee DiResta. We're talking about misinformation and disinformation, elections, health. I wanted to talk to this idea of deep fakes. So just for those of you who haven't been following, the computer science community has created increasingly powerful ability to mimic the voice and the face in images and movies of people and things that are indistinguishable or approaching being indistinguishable to the unaided human eye from reality. And so there is a worry about having these be released into the world, and then people saying, well, I saw a picture is worth 1,000 words, and I am now 100% convinced of something that was never said or never done by the person who they thought they were watching. Does the deep fake world intersect with the Internet Observatory's work? And what can you tell us about the future there?
Yeah, it does. It does intersect with our work. So, so the Internet Observatory focuses on the, you know, misuse of the internet. So ways, not only election related disinformation, we also have a much broader collection of research that we do. And Alex teaches a class in trust and safety. And one of the things that
this is Alex Stamos, one of the founders of that lab.
Yep. And so we do think about things like harassment, actually, and revenge porn, right? And deepfakes, actually, that's been their major use case, not political misinformation, but unfortunately, you know, putting your ex's face on some actress and, you know, posting the video to the internet. And for people who don't have a large body of search results for their name, this, of course, becomes a reputational hit. And there's also the question of it, you know, being uploaded to certain types of sites. Interestingly, I think some of the first policy on deepfakes was set by Pornhub and that kind of community, which began having to take these videos down, and the and it used non-consensuality actually as the policy justification for doing that. So just sort of interesting, you know, internet history from 2 years ago.
Yeah.
But the way that we also look at it, you know, on the political front, when you make a video, first of all, they still do kind of fall into the uncanny valley. There are certain things that just don't seem quite right.
Correct.
So there is this, and there are ways to detect, you know, certain, you know, respiration and heartbeat, you know, certain signatures that that you would have if you were actually being, you know, a video of an actual person as opposed to a generated video. So there are certain things that it doesn't get 100% right. And so there are detection mechanisms.
And I know lips move funny and eyebrows are sometimes funky.
Yeah, there's like micro expressions don't quite fit. Yeah. There's certain things that aren't quite there. But the interesting thing though is also if you use a deep fake video of a politician, you do need footage of the person in order to you know to get a convincing video. You need to have some material. Not a lot now. Increasingly that amount of content needed decreases. But what happens is if you create a political deep fake, you're going to have immediately tons of people, reporters in particular, investigating it. You're going to have image authenticators and digital forensic analysts going and trying to understand what has happened here, particularly because usually you would use that video to make a sensational claim. This is the same is true of audio, right? The hot mic leak kind of thing.
Right.
Audio, you have even less to go on, right? You have the voice of the person, the purported voice of the person, but you don't have the heartbeat and the visuals to kind of, you know, to look
do,
at
do
for
a
the detection.
Fiducial checking.
Yeah. So there are, you know, ways in which audio is potentially more, you know, has the potential to be more impactful. But even one of the things that we're looking at SIO is also text-based generated content in general, not only generated video, but the language models like GPT-3 from OpenAI, which is a model in which the AI produces plausible human-seeming output in the form of text.
Yeah.
And so that's
it's
another thing
that we're
looking
at. It's written an editorial for The Guardian.
Right, so The
Guardian...
I remember
the editor said it was roughly the same as editing any editorial that comes across his or her desk.
What I found when I was working with it was that it could, with some training and the right prompt, it could produce a paragraph or two that was plausible. And one thing that's interesting is that it will generate a whole story about a purported historical moment that is complete fiction, but it reads so convincingly. So I was using it to look at some content related to an actual disinformation campaign because I was curious about, you know, could you use an AI to generate this type of content, these types of like fake, you know, Russia makes these fake blog posts. And I was curious, like, to what extent, well, sorry, they're real blog posts by fake people.
Right.
And I was curious, you know, does it do a better job at producing plausible tweets? How is its long form? And I found that it would generate these stories where I would go and I would Google And it would do things like it would say, and, you know, it would come up with a researcher name, a real person, and then it would attribute an affiliation to them from, you know, one of them was MIT Media Lab. And then it would come up with whatever they had done, you know, was an expert in such and such. And I would go and I would Google, and like the person exists and the institution exists. And of course the rough field exists, but the three things don't connect. Yeah. So I'm Googling around here. And the thing that was so funny to me was, even knowing that it had just been produced by an AI, I still felt compelled. You know, I was like, well, maybe I'm just searching for the wrong thing. You know?
Right.
Like, maybe this professor was at MIT, but it was prior to the era of the internet.
Wow.
And there's no record of it. You know, so I'm finding myself Googling, trying to make this all make sense.
I know it's been a present and active thing that you've been doing for this election, but it's a partnership. So what's the idea, and did it work?
Yeah, so we decided that in the monitoring, so detecting misinformation is challenging, right? And that's because there is so much, there's so many platforms, so many themes in an election, there's certain states that matter, themes that matter, candidates that matter. So we narrowly scoped to looking at content related to voting, misinformation and disinformation related to voting, the process, you know, how it happens, where it happens, et cetera, the legitimacy of the vote. So we did this with three other institutions. We did it with University of Washington Center for an Informed Public, Graphica, which is a tech company that does a lot of fantastic network analysis and misinformation detection, and DFR Lab, Digital Forensic Research Lab of the Atlantic Council, which does work somewhat similar to what we do at the Observatory, looking for political misinformation worldwide. And we built this coalition because each of the four core entities had both quantitative and qualitative research capabilities. And what we did was, we wanted to make sure that we were having the greatest degree of visibility into communities that were likely to be targeted. And so we partnered with civil society organizations that work with and serve those communities. We wanted to make sure that we were in touch with government. So CISA out of Department of Homeland Security, and FBI has the Foreign Influence Task Force. So there are certain entities that were set up after 2016 to try to ensure the integrity of the American election, to make sure it was free of foreign interference, but also against, you know, domestic manipulators to some extent.
Yeah.
As well.
So a very cool partnership with academic and industry and government. Like,
yep. And we communicated regularly with journalists. We wanted to make sure that we were helping to contextualize information. So yes, there is this misinformation about Sharpies on ballots in Arizona, and here's where it came from. Here's how it's spreading. This is what it looks like. We wanted to make sure that we could also help people not unnecessarily amplify things that were going nowhere, tree falling in the woods kind of, you know. Yeah. Yes, somebody is wrong on the internet, but you don't need to cover it. Versus the narratives that were beginning to take hold, get legs, and hop from community to community.
Thank you for listening to The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app.
This has been The Future of Everything with Russ Altman on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.